Just got a free coffee with my EarnIFI points.
Your what?
The points I get with the new EarnIFI app from BP and Amoco. I got 250 for signing up and more every time I fill up or buy anything in the C-store.
Oh, can you use points for fuel?
Of course.
And discounts and deals?
On anything.
Oh, like chips?
Mm-hmm.
Sodas?
You got it.
The actual slushy machine.
Only what's actually for sale. But you do get double the points for the first 90 days. Just go to EarnIFIRewards.com to download the app.
Available at participating locations only. App content is subject to change.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Thursday, October 10th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Season 4 of the Apple TV Plus spy series Slow Horses, and we will present an interview with showrunner Will Smith. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at SlashFilm.com. I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
All right, Jacob, let's kick things off here. I guess before we get into spoilers, just broad strokes, what did you think about Slow Horses Season 4?
This is my favorite book in the series. I've read all the books that this series is based on.
How many are there? Like 11 or something at this point?
There's 8 of them right now, I believe, and then a book of short stories.
Okay. Yeah, that's right.
I think he's still planning to publish, you know, one every year or two at this point. But this is my favorite book in the series so far for a lot of reasons. And like the previous seasons, I think this is a pretty masterful adaptation in what it chooses to stay faithful to, what it chooses to expand, and what it chooses to change. I mean, the books are generally maybe 2 hours worth of story. They really are books if you like movies. So the show really has to find clever ways to expand the material. And I'm consistently blown away how they function as adaptations and how they make how the show makes those choices. I'm not sure if season four is the best season of the show, just because it... I'll not have the capacity to say it's the best season just because in the same way that I think the book's the best book, but it's certainly just as good as previous seasons. And the stuff that I love in the book is present here. And I find this show so hopelessly addictive. Once I start a new season, I just can't stop watching. I chose to binge this season. I chose to let it all build up and watch it all the past 2 days. Because I would find watching this show weekly to be infuriating because of how it's structured. This might be the only show, Ben, that I prefer binging over watching week to week because I find it so addictive.
Yeah, I do the same thing. And I think that's crucial because I'm guessing a lot of our listeners and a lot of people that watch the show do watch it week to week. And I feel like that's a whole different experience just in terms of the pacing of the thing. And like, if you have that week to week experience, you have more time to think about maybe some of the flaws in the show or some of the things that don't work as well for you or whatever. And I wonder if that's a big part of why I love this show is because I just tear through every season in a big chunk, you know, as soon as it comes out. So I'm curious about that because I've kind of sensed a slight downtick in passion for the show in the fandom this season. But yeah, personally, I'm not getting tired of Slow Horses yet. Like I still love these characters. I love spending time with them. I love Jackson Lamb's perpetual a combination of slovenly and ridiculously competent. And I love the blend of the action and the grounded personal stakes, all of it. So I was wondering if you felt any, you said this was just as good, but I was wondering if you feel any wear and tear in the show so far.
Honestly, no. And as somebody who's trying to be less online, I did not realize that there was any kind of downtick in enthusiasm. To me, this felt like the same show. I mean, I know the show changes directors each season, so there always are stylistic changes. And I was noticing how this, you know, season feels and looks very differently than previous seasons, which is something I come to accept as, you know, which each season is going to be. But beyond that aesthetic change, and maybe this is definitely more of a River Cartwright-centric season. Jackson Lamb is maybe not as front and center, so maybe people want more of him. But as somebody who appreciates the ensemble, I'm all for what the season is doing. In fact, there's a profile on Mick Herron, the writer of the books, I believe it was a New Yorker profile, where he talked about a meeting where he went to a publisher and they tried to rebrand the series as the Jackson Lamb Mysteries. And he said, oh, I want to kill Jackson Lamb off, which he was joking and lying, but it freaked them out and convinced them to not call it the Jackson Lamb Mysteries anymore. So it's my long-winded way of saying that this is an ensemble show, and I like that this season feels comfortable letting Gary Oldman kind of, you know, be the third most important person on the show instead of the first. So is that what people are upset? That'll be my first guess is why people may be less warm in the season if they're not River Cartwright fans.
Yeah, I think some of it's a little bit of that, a little bit of some pacing issues maybe. Like I, we'll talk in just a minute about like maybe aspects or relationships or moments that stood out to us that maybe we liked or maybe that we didn't care for as much or wish that were done better. And I'll bring up some of that there. But okay, so I want to put a spoiler warning on this conversation now. So we're free to talk about anything that happens in season four, but really anything in the show if we want to go back that far. So if you've not caught up with the show yet, please do. Jacob and I love it so much. So yeah, this is just a full-throated recommendation from both of us. So okay, so you mentioned you read Spook Street, which is the book that this season was based on. I guess because you've read so many of these books, are you able to keep the events of individual books distinct in your mind? Or do you have in your head like how these two versions of this story compare? Are there things that the book did better or the show did better? Or what do you think about the breakdown there?
I can largely differentiate the books. I can't tell you like a beat for beat, but the same way that I read almost all the Jack Reacher books and oh, that's the one where he goes to Nebraska, or that's the one where he does this. Since we're on full spoiler mode, this is the one where like in my head, it's, oh, that's the one where Frank Harkness shows up. Rivers, yeah, ex-CIA agent, scumbag, psychopath dad. And I think played really well by Hugo Weaving. I think that's a really impeccable casting. He's a really real piece of shit in this show. I think he plays him really well. But one thing Slow Horses always does as a TV show is that I think it makes the characters about 20% more competent and adds about 30% more action. It'd be my mathematical equation if I had to, you know, pull it out of my butt. The books are a lot more low key. There are fewer gunfights, fewer chases, fewer action beats in the books. I think the show very wisely knows, oh, it's been an hour without something spy happening. Let's add a chase scene. And I think that it never feels like it's being forced. It never feels like it's there for the sake of being there. It's just an understanding that when you're not allowed to be in a character's head and where the drama isn't, you know, the internal narration driving why you're interested, you've got to find ways to keep the audience, you know, gripped. And I think that by expanding the action in Slow Horses TV show, it's a really smart way to do that. Similarly, the characters in the books are, as the very premise of the story, everybody here are screw ups. Nobody on this cast is somebody who is supposed to be good at their job, but they are more competent in the show to a pretty severe degree. They actually get things accomplished in the show in ways that they don't always do in the books. And once again, it's a smart choice because as a reader, when I'm inside their heads, I can really sympathize and be on board with these screw-ups. But the show has to let them have wins. A TV show at least lets characters occasionally have a victory, occasionally have a moment to celebrate. And I think that season four does a really good job of taking a book where, in the end, not a lot gets accomplished and the heroes all lose, and give it just enough of a tinge of victory, even though it's still a bittersweet one in the end. I hope this all makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, so yeah, I did want to like sort of run through some aspects or relationships or moments or anything like that that really stood out to you from the season in the positive column, and then maybe we'll get to things that maybe you didn't care for or wish could have been done a little bit better. So starting things off positively, I just kind of wrote down a few bullet points that I'll run through real quick, and then I'll turn it over to you. I love the dynamic between Taverner and the new first desk guy, Claude Whelan. I just loved seeing how bumbling and incompetent he was. So I don't know if you have anything to say about those characters or that relationship.
Yeah, I love the Taverner Whelan dynamic. He is he's played by James Callis, who I know as Gaius Baltar from Battlestar Galactica. And you can see why they cast him, because both these characters are guys who are so impressive to look at, and in bite-sized chunks seem competent, but the moment they're put under pressure or the moment you go behind the scenes with them, they completely fall apart. And watching these two duel throughout the season is one of my favorite aspects of the show. And I love Taverner because, God, she's such a great semi-villain or semi-anti-hero. I don't know what you even call her, because depending on the scene, she's either, you know, on her character's side or actively fighting against them. But she's always the most competent person in the room, and watching the most competent person in the room have to coexist with someone so staggeringly incompetent, but who has all the power to mask that is such a fun dynamic.
Yeah, it really is. I loved the addition of Emma Flight, this new character who's kind of the new leader of the dogs. I really dug her and just the way that she approached her job. And you kind of get the sense that like, oh, maybe she's not great at what she's doing. And then over the course of the season, you realize that she's like holding back because she doesn't necessarily trust the authority figures that she's working for. And all of her instincts prove to be correct for the most part. So I liked that, the addition of that character. And I look forward to seeing what they do with her moving forward.
It's fun to have a character who is whose whole thing is that she's in the right. Emma Flight is always doing the right thing. But in a world where every single character, even the heroes, are always doing the wrong thing and trying to justify it, which means an instant clash on all sides for her, which makes her a really fun addition.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You'll hear me tell Will Smith this in the conversation that we're about to play, but I thought the shootout in the London streets at the end of episode 5, where River gets abducted, was just phenomenal. Like, so scary and incredibly effective. I just loved that, the way that that led into what I think might be the best season finale so far. I kind of agree that maybe this isn't the best overall season, but I thought this season ended so strongly with this finale and leading in and sort of teeing up the action that we get there with that really horrifying, fatal scene at the very end of episode 5. I thought it was just incredibly well done. So did you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, if I had to nitpick season 3 at all, season 3 has a lot of action in the back half. I think that there are times where it really leans into the action being a bit too cool and a bit too stylish for these characters. Whereas I think this season really dials back the action to be, as you said, scary. These characters are not super heroic. They are not James Bond or Ethan Hunt. They are very ordinary people. So the gunfights in season 4 are portrayed as being frightening events as opposed to like exciting action scenes. And I want more of this going forward. I'm not saying season 3 did a wrong choice, but I'm saying I think I prefer this for how these characters should engage in action.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I had written down in the positive column was the David Cartwright scenes, which Jonathan Pryce just knocked it out of the park this season. It's so heartbreaking. And especially at the very end, the scene with him and River, where River puts him in the home, is just, it just ripped my heart right out of my body. So what do you think about Jonathan Pryce and the way that that character is given more to do this season, and his dementia or Alzheimer's or whatever is sort of coming to the fore, and the problems that that presents for the Slough House characters?
Yeah, I love Jonathan Pryce in this role. I love Jonathan Pryce in general. I think he's just one of those actors who's been so good for so long. And I feel like he's only in the past 20 years or so started to get like the accolades for being that good. And his character, David Cartwright, is, I love that they spend the first few seasons building up to being the smartest guy in the room, a guy who he's no longer in a position of actual power, but still maintains power. People respect him and know him. And the moment his mind goes, it's like a switch gets flipped. We see signs of it in the previous season, but between then and now, it happens with such ferocity. It's so quick how far he falls. And the tragedy of that is, it's so funny to talk about this, call it a tragedy, because David Cartwright is so frequently revealed to be a pretty nasty piece of work, a guy who served his country by doing the worst possible things. And now that he no longer is in a position to wield that power, nobody cares anymore. He's just piece on the board. A guy can be knocked off or killed or locked up, and nobody, he's just a loose end. And seeing a guy who had all the pieces in seasons 1, 2 and, you know, half of 3 suddenly have zero power, and having him be just cognizant enough to realize that, the moments where Jonathan Pryce lets us see that David Cartwright is aware of what's happening to him, that's when it broke me. He's very good in the scenes where he's just sort of losing his mind a little bit and rambling. But when he returns to himself for those key moments and realizes, oh no, I'm aware, is absolutely shattering. And the fact that I am so deeply caring about a character who honestly deserves to be locked up and, you know, in the key thrown away, is a testament to the performance.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, so things that I maybe didn't care for or wish could have been done a little bit better or differently or whatever. This is kind of like nitpicking for the most part, because again, I really love the show. But I wish Ko, the new quiet guy at Slough House, was utilized more throughout the season. I thought, you know, obviously he had some big moments in the finale, but he was just kind of like there lurking for most of the season, didn't really contribute much. But I'm not going to ask you to like tell me how that character factors into future books or future stories or anything like that. But what did you think about Ko as he was portrayed in just this season of TV?
This is where I have the advantage, because I know where Ko's storyline goes. And I think that Tom Brooke, who plays him, really nails that character. I don't want to spoil anything. All I'll say is that knowing where this character goes, I was very pleased by his performance and how he's utilized here. And I do think it's intentional that he's meant to be shuffled off in the background for a bit, which makes his, when he starts getting to the action, be all the more surprising, especially in the finale where he makes a very brazen choice. But yeah, he's definitely a character who is being set up for, you know, future drama. And I'll leave it at that. I mean, if you watch the preview for season 5, that plays after the end of season 4 finale, you get to see Ko in the action a lot more. And I will say that he definitely gets more into things in the next book / season. And I hope you will learn to appreciate Ko as much as I appreciate Ko. But then again, I'm approaching as a reader, so I'm biased.
I never watch the trailers for the next season thing that always pop up, because I'm already just like so hooked on the show that I feel like it would be even more heartbreaking to get that tease of like what's coming and know that I have to wait a whole year or something, even though this is apparently one of the few shows these days that actually returns on a pretty consistent basis. You know, you don't have those 2 or 3 year gaps between seasons like you do for so many big shows. And I love that about Slow Horses, but I think it would break my heart too much, because I love the show so much. And I think you said this in our Slack earlier, that you could just like, the 6-episode season thing is great because you can just blow through a season really quickly, but also it's terrible because you blow through a season really quickly and you just want to spend more time with these characters and more time in this world. And so, as soon as I'm done with the season, I'm like, all right, I'm not even going to watch this trailer, because I know that I would be thinking about it so much more than I would be otherwise until I wait for the show to come back. But
how do you feel about the big character death this season?
The Marcus one? Is that what you mean?
Yeah,
that was actually the next thing that I had written down, which like RIP Marcus. I actually think that this happened at a good time, because I thought this season his dynamic with Shirley was starting to feel just a little bit repetitive. And so I like that this is a show that can and has killed off main characters before. I feel like there's probably plot armor around Jackson Lamb and River Cartwright and maybe Catherine Standish. Like, I feel like nothing's really going to happen to the three of them until maybe the very end of the show or something like that. But it kind of feels like all of the other characters are, maybe expendable is the wrong word, but are in danger in a real way. And the show, I think, has really leaned into that. And I think Marcus's sacrifice played out pretty well this season. I just kind of feel like that character was maybe like spinning his wheels a little bit. So I'm actually glad that that happened here. But what did you think about that?
Yeah, I think they do it. It's different in the book. I think the book, everybody's far less heroic, and they give Marcus a far more dignified end than he gets in the book. So I'll leave there in case anybody wants to get around to reading it. But yeah, I appreciate how no one feels safe. And the subtext in the books that's become essentially text in the show, and I think it's the right choice to make it more obvious, that Jackson Lamb doesn't actively care about his colleagues in the sense of he wants to be their buddy. He doesn't want like to be friendly, but he does care about people surviving and is deeply wounded by having been around so much violence. I really like the moment where Shirley tries to leave the room and Jackson Lamb says, you know, don't go out there, essentially implying that Marcus is dead. It's a shattering bit of acting from Gary Oldman, where like you see that mask slip and you realize that. I love it when Jackson Lamb's mask slips, because that doesn't happen in the book. He's always like, the book carries Jackson Lamb's like damage really close to the vest. You only see it in the tiniest little bits, whereas Gary Oldman lets you see the fact that he is a wounded guy who is deeply affected by all this violence. he wears it a bit more plainly. And it's sad that Marcus is gone, but also this is what I want from the show, which is to see how Jackson Lamb navigates this completely ruined world that he inhabits.
Yes. Yeah. That's really, really well said. Yeah. The moment where he's like negotiating with Taverner, or basically demanding that Marcus get, or his family get, like the full, what was it? His pension should be paid out as if he was a field agent, right? Like that's the conversation that he's having there. Yeah. You know, I can't remember a time when he ever had a conversation with Marcus that didn't involve an insult, or that was just, he never has legitimate conversations with anybody, which is why I think the moment with River in the pub at the very, very end, like the closing shot of the season, is so powerful, because he lets him stay and he just says, yeah, you can stay, you can have a drink, but just shut up and don't say anything. And that alone says so much about the evolution between those characters and their relationship. So I thought all that stuff really worked well for me. The last thing that I'll mention is that I wish there had been more of Hugo Weaving. You mentioned him earlier. He's great. The scene where he interrogates Molly at her apartment was so terrifying and just really, really well done. He was another character that was kind of like lurking for a little bit. I mean, obviously he had more to do than Co this season, but I kind of like wanted more of him, and I'm guessing we'll see more of him because of the way that the season ends, where he kind of is able to wriggle out of being arrested and thrown into the park and interrogated by Taverner and all that. So it seems like he's going to be a character that's going to be popping up in some capacity moving forward. So I just kind of wish we had more with him, because Hugo Weaving is so great, and I wanted to see, like, maybe I'm asking for something that I don't actually really want, because I think the scene in the finale between River and Hugo Weaving's character was Frank was so good, probably because they hadn't met up until that point, you know, like the withholding and the it creates the sense in the audience of you just want those storylines to collide. When they finally do, it's really satisfying. So maybe I'm asking for something that I don't actually want, but maybe it's just Hugo Weaving is so good that I just want to see more of him, you know?
Yeah, it's very much a case where how much is too much of this guy, because he is definitely left to be just enough of a mystery, and he's definitely left to, as you say, he's left to live another day. And all I'll say is that, yes, he is still alive after the fourth book as well. So you are correct that you will likely see him again. And yeah, I'll leave it there.
Okay. Any other things that you wanted to mention, moments that stood out to you, or things that you thought maybe could have been done a little bit better, anything like that?
I really like how this season is directed. I don't have the director's name in front of me right now, if you could pull it up while I speak.
But, yeah, we'll do.
There is a real attention to letting action play out in long shots, and not necessarily flashy tracking shots, but scenes where the camera will pan or dolly forward and back in ways where the staging of a scene is constantly shifting and evolving, and the blocking of the characters is always changing, but without cuts, and allows this really interesting rhythm to both the action and the suspense scenes. And even the comedy, the biggest laugh of the entire season is when River escapes by rooftop, gives a rude gesture to his pursuers and falls through the rusted roof of the building he's on, all in one shot as the camera like goes down with him as he falls. I just felt that the director here did a really fabulous job of letting these leisurely camera movements emphasize everything from dramatic action to comedy. I thought it was really impressive in a low-key way. I never felt like I was watching, ooh, a tracking shot, but I would notice, oh, this shot hasn't cut, and it has allowed so much to play out. I think I really liked how the season was shot.
Totally. Yeah. So shout out to Adam Randall, who directed every episode of this season. And yeah, as you said, I think they get different directors for every season, and they kind of knock them out in blocks and stuff. So I'm not sure if they've announced who's going to be directing season 5 yet, but that season, I believe, is pretty close to done. I asked Will Smith about that in the interview. So anything else you wanted to mention, Jacob, before we go to that interview?
Well, I think we covered most of what I wanted to say. I don't know how many other ways I can say this show is real good and I like it.
Yeah, same. I feel exactly the same way. And I feel like I'm trying to tell everyone in my life, like, you got to see this show. It's just so freaking enjoyable. So yeah, this is me doing that one more time. And let's take a break, and then we'll come back and present my interview with showrunner Will Smith. Will, congratulations on, first of all, on winning your most recent Emmy for writing Slow Horses, and then also on season 4. It's just an incredible show, one of my favorite things on TV. So congrats, and thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you. That's really lovely to hear. Thank you so much.
Yes. So in your acceptance speech and in several other interviews, you're always very clear about crediting Mick Herron in his Sly House novels as a big part of the reason the show is as good as it is. And I haven't actually read any of those books yet myself, but I have a colleague who has, and he says that the show manages to stay faithful to the books while also making some pretty significant changes. So I was wondering how you determine when to diverge. Have you discovered any patterns at this point about how you approach that decision?
Yeah, we normally find that the books give us about 4 eps and give us some really great kind of, you know, endings. And then the sort of climax of the book would normally take 1 ep, but and we kind of have to build out from that to make it 2. So we're always building out. And that's really lovely to hear that it's faithful to it. And that's what we always try and do, is be faithful to the spirit of the books and just try and tell the same story in different ways and keep the essence of the characters, even if we cast to a sort of different physical types than they're described in the books. And just keeping it tonally within Mick's world, because, you know, we all really love the books. So it's kind of like, well, why change them? It's like, you know, why are we trying to adapt them if you just want to throw it all out and just kind of take it as a starting point, and then you could do anything. You think, well, you may as well just create your own thing. Whereas what Mick does is, you know, the characters are so kind of distinct and so intriguing. And but he's also very, very generous. Like he'll often say to the actors, if the actors have any questions about the characters, that if it's not on the page, I don't know. That like he doesn't really think beyond what he's put down, but he's happy for them to kind of fill in the blanks as they see fit, which, you know, and they always do in a kind of really interesting way that to me is always true to what Mick started.
Yeah, that's cool. Where are you right now in the process of filming or writing, or what stage are you at right now?
We are editing series 5, and then we've still got some days overhanging from the main shoot, so we've got some stuff to pick up on that.
Are you typically on set for every day of filming?
Yeah, not every day, but most, you know, like as much as I can. I mean, you know, I don't do all the nights, but that's because I'm, you know, not just because I mean, I would, but it's like I have to do things in the day to do with the show. So I can't go fully nocturnal when the rest of the crew do. But I always try and go for, you know, as much as I can, definitely all the sort of key character scenes. And it's partly because I love, you know, I love being there. I love interacting with the actors. I love watching it. And, you know, honestly, when I watch it on the monitors, I turn into a fan. I'm just like, it's just like watching the show for me, which is magic. But also there's always something that I'll kind of add in or a question they'll have. So there's always little kind of adjustments that we do. And as well, like, you know, watching them, it always gives me ideas for the next one and kind of like talk to them about it. And I just think, you know, the closer you work with your cast, the better, really. And so, yeah, I love all aspects of the show. I love being in the room. I love, you know, doing rehearsals when we get to do them. I love the shoot. You know, I really love, you know, taking part in the edit and just seeing it all come together is just fascinating. And yeah, it's just great.
Is there a performance moment from season 4 that you can think of where an actor did something that surprised you?
I mean, I can say it. Jonathan Pryce consistently blew me away with every take he did. And that's already starting from a very high bar because, you know, Jonathan's just amazing. And just, you know, and then watching him in this, I really love how his character has this, you know, arc across the seasons, really. And have you seen the whole of series 4 or just oh, right? Yeah. So I don't know when this is going out and whether it's
this will go up after the season finale, so we can talk about the whole season.
Oh yeah, I mean that. Yeah, because I mean, that final scene where River puts him in the care home, I went and wrote that off the back of watching him, Jonathan and Jack record the scene in series 3 where Jack has to go down to the members club and tell him that he's no longer a member, and he cancelled his membership and he's forgotten, and just seeing how much kind of sadness and pride and pain there was in the way they performed that, I could just feel, oh, it can go even kind of deeper, really, and sadder. so watching Jonathan do that, and just where he gets to a place where he looks so lost in his eyes, it's so compelling that this character just is just in a kind of mental fog, and just bits are coming to him and going, and to the point where he would do these pauses that would be so deep that you'd literally think, has he forgotten the line? And then he'd be back in, and you're like, no, he's just a brilliant actor. But it was so, he just so conveyed somebody who did not know where he was or what to say next, that you know your reaction as somebody who's watching it being performed and made is he's actually forgotten, but of course he hadn't. He just was so kind of submerged in the part that's how he made it feel. So yeah, so I mean Jonathan all the time, I mean Saskia all the time. Gary is just a marvel and is a constant wonder to watch and to work with, and you know, just the depths he conveys as Lamb is, you know, without going into detail, just the kind of, just he sort of wears the scars of Lamb. You just get the sense of all he's been through without having to go into specifics, that you know the stuff he's faced down.
Yeah. Man, it's so good. Especially that, I mean, yeah, going back to Jonathan, that because I just rewatched the last episode before I was chatting with you, and that care home scene is just a dagger right to the heart. It's so
it's
good.
Horrible, isn't it? Yeah. I remember Jay at Apple saying, this is great, but do you really want to do this?
Yeah, like, man,
it's so sad. It's just, but it, I mean, it's sort of true. And what I, you know, and that's, I don't think that scene is in the books. I'd have to, I get blurred. It's like, sometimes I'm like, is that Mick or me, or what, did we invent that, or what? It's, you know, but I'm pretty sure it's not. But he is, but in he's in a care home in book five, so it's kind of I sort of wanted to show that scene, and I think the reason I wanted to do it is one of the reasons things I love about the show is that it's a spy show, but it's full of human issues that are common to everyone, and I just think it just feels really interesting and fresh to kind of show people's difficult home lives and how that impinges on their work. And you know, and it's just very moving, and just as an arc of just in that series of, you know, Jack finding his father, but his father, you know, is a monster, losing his grandfather who has raised him as a kind of father, and then being left at the end with Jackson Lamb as his only kind of functional father figure, and that's the best option. And I just think there's a sort of beautiful tragic pain in that.
Yeah.
That Jack, you know, and Gary and Jonathan can just all play the hell out of, because they're all just the best actors of their generations.
Yeah, absolutely. So every season of Slow Horses adapts a single novel, and it's not shy about each season telling one long story. And this season-long story approach has often been derided by viewers and critics for leading to slow, meandering TV, but that does not apply to Slow Horses at all. So what is the secret to telling one single extended narrative over 6 hours without leading to dull patches or wasted episodes?
Well, I mean, that's great to hear that. And that's something we really try, is to not, you know, no filler or padding or treading water. And so you always want it to feel it's moving on. And that's something I really took from working for Amanda Iannucci, was that it's all, don't repeat, move on, change it up the whole time. And so I've kind of got that impulse. And then, you know, and Apple and the other execs, they're on the kind of, you know, pace, keep it going. And all, so that's their kind of their note, which is fantastic. And then also the source material, again, I have to kind of take my hat off to Mick here, and he really helps us, because most of the books are set over 2 to 3 days maximum. So it's kind of, once the story starts, it kind of rips. And so you're kind of, the reason it feels so propulsive is it's for the characters, it's propulsive. They're just in that story. There's no kind of, you know, 6 months later, kind of, you know, cut to a week later. There's no, nothing kind of treads water story-wise on the timeline. There's mm-hmm. no pause in the timeline. So it just has, it lends itself to that drive, much as it means for the crew. There's a lot of night shoots, a lot of night, and I do get a kind of, could it all be in the day next time? But I mean, it suits the genre as well. The nighttime, the kind of shadows and dark and all of that is part of the feel of the show. So unfortunately, it runs over kind of day night, and then we're out. But that, as you say, that gives it its propulsion.
Yeah, and speaking of night, there's this moment at the end of the fifth episode of season four that takes place at night where there's this ambush, this horrifying ambush in the streets of London that reminded me a little bit of something like The Terminator. Tell me about writing that ambush.
Oh, well, that, I mean, yeah, it's, and again, I think it's in the book, but it's, I think it's a car smash in that, and it's sort of quicker and less brutal, and I think there's less death. And then with this, we just wanted to up it with a truck, and like Adam Randall, who's just a fantastic director of series four, who did just the most amazing job. But yeah, he and I love, we're big fans of Michael Mann's Heat and Terminator, and it's sort of got that kind of, that kind of brutality. We definitely thought of like Patrice, the villain who just keeps coming, the hitman who won't stop. We definitely referred to him as having a Terminator-like quality. And I think it was just, you know, the chance to just do really kind of hard-edged, kind of shocking action that we hadn't really done that kind of register of action before. Because there was a lot of action at the end of series three, but there was sort of jeopardy in the numbers. Like the soldiers that were coming in were kind of, they weren't the best soldiers, but there were a lot of them, and that's what gave the kind of life or death struggle and that. Whereas in this, it's like it's one guy, but he's lethal, and so it had a different kind of tone and energy. But I couldn't wait to do that, especially like Ep 6. I remember reading the book and thinking that's just such a brilliant thing to do, is to set up this precinct where nothing ever happens and bring trouble right to the door. You know, have somebody kick the door and go up the building shooting. It was just felt like, oh wow, that's just great.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I know that it would be a while before this happens, but since Gary has said that he's happy to continue playing this character for as long as people are interested in watching the show, have you thought about what might happen if you catch up to Mick's books?
I know, because I think we're way off that. I think Mick's working on the ninth, and then there's also kind of ancillary kind of sidebar novels in the same world as well that we could sort of explore if we were having to give him time to write. So I think we're a way off that, but you know, and there's just so many riches ahead in terms of what Mick is doing. But it's incredibly flattering to hear that, you know, Gary's happy to do this forever. It sort of slightly blows my mind, but it's a very rich character, and it's a sort of fascinating character, because there's an enigma to the character, which is there's always things you can reveal about his backstory that are kind of little windows into what made of the man he is that I think are really intriguing, and that's something we push on in series five, which I'm really excited about. I hope people will respond to as fulsomely as they have the previous four series.
I love it. It's just the little hints that we get into that character. You guys are riding that balance perfectly. So it's
yeah. Perfect. Well, it's just great. You know, you know, when he's feet up behind the desk, not doing anything, but when he actually, as River says, when he actually gets off his ass, he's pretty hard to beat. And that's that's just a fun character for the audience, that somebody who everyone kind of overlooks and just dismisses, you know, at their peril, as just, you know, a kind of drunken old kind of fool, in the way that Flight does in Ep 1. And also in a way that a lot of people just dismiss Catherine and overlook Catherine and just think, you know, just this sort of grey woman that they don't pay any attention to. But actually, she's really smart. And, yeah. You know, whereas River, who's always front and centre and driving things, he's not quite as good as he thinks he is.
Right, yeah. There's something so enjoyable about watching competent characters, you know, people who know exactly what they're doing. It's just so addictive almost. Yeah. You mentioned that Gary is a writer and director himself in other interviews, and like his notes are always valuable to you and your team. I was wondering if you can think of a time when maybe he said something that made you rethink the way that you were going to approach a scene or something like that.
There's always one scene a series that we're always really happy with going into, and then we do it and it just feels wrong. And I usually rewrite it overnight and we do it a couple of days later. But it's always Gary's rate. Gary will just feel off. It's just like, it's not quite Lamb, or like we're making it too comic or too expositional, or there's just, so it's always one that just feels it's playing wrong. I mean, the one in this one, I think it was when he first meets Moira, and we had it was more an extended riff where she's tidying his room and he was pretending how much he loved it. And it was sort of, we thought it'd be fun to have the audience thinking, why is he acting like this? And then, you know, he's just trying to sort of soft soap her so he can, you know, drop the hammer on her and go, you know, you shouldn't be here. I don't want you here. Go and find out, you know, Why David Went to France, and it just felt a bit too, it was a bit too contrived, basically. And so we just did a much simpler version where he's just in and just is like, let's go for lunch, and goes out and just says to Marcus and Shirley, put it back how it was. And so it's things like that. If it feels like it's just that was just a little too big, probably. But generally, his most consistent note is, you know, I can do that with a look. But it's not, and even that isn't a lot now. But then it'll just be kind of just refining and smoothing. But he gets into the learning process very early on, so he kind of, we saw that a lot of all that's done by the time we're filming. It's like he's kind of locked into it, because the reason he's able to give this sort of performances where it just feels like it's absolutely happening is because he's not even thinking about the line. He's not remembering the line at all. It's just, it's in there, and it just comes out of him.
Yeah, I was thinking about Gary's performance and also with Jonathan Pryce as well. Like, these characters are duplicitous in a way, or sort of almost the characters are acting in a sense too, and in a lot of it too. So like, when you're writing for those characters specifically, how do you go about hitting the target of where, for the David Cartwright character, where he's actually experiencing dementia, or where he is like purposefully trying to obscure the truth, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think we went through quite a lot of that in the drafting, I'm remembering, as to what, if he's playing or not. But I'm not sure when he, I mean, Jonathan is so layered that it's sort of his choices in some way. Like, he, I mean, because I think most of the time, I think once the shooting has happened, once Rivers left him, then it feels like he's full on kind of in and out of what happened, what didn't happen, then it's all a bit of a jumble. But there's a moment when they're in the bathroom where where River reads out the names and says, and asks him if, and the place, and says, does that place mean anything to you, Levond? And then I'm now blanking on the name in the passport, which I should know. But I've done another series since then. So that's
Adam Lockhead, maybe?
Adam Lockhead, that's it, yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. Well done. So, and he says the names, and Jonathan's reaction is, he says, no, it doesn't mean anything to me. But you know, in that, the way he says it, that he does. And I can't even break down how he is doing that.
It seems like such an interesting writing challenge when you have actors who are that good and can convey so much information with just a look, to be able to dial that in as a writer of like, okay, here's a moment where maybe Jonathan can give us a look that means
that's what comes from being on set and I mean, obviously watching the, you know, the assemblies and watching the edit and all that kind of stuff, but I just think when you're on set, you just absorb what the skill set, for that's quite a, you know, pedestrian term for what they do, really, but the kind of the process or the approach or the kind of the rhythms, and you just get a feel for what they can do and what they enjoy and what, where it can go and how they're playing the character. So some of that is sort of subconscious after a while. You're writing to the rhythms, you're writing to sort of the character, you know, as created by Mick and interpreted by me and then interpreted by the actor, and so it's sort of that layered thing where you're mixing them all together, and that just sort of comes out. I mean, my favorite sort of scene in terms of people, actors playing characters who are acting, is where Lam turns up at Catherine's at the end of Act One and, you know, to tell her that, you know, River's dead, and the audience don't know this yet, but she knows River's alive and Lam knows River's alive, because she's seen him, but so it's Saskia actually as Catherine trying to act to Lam as though this is a shock to her, and it's such a hard line to walk, and it's there's enough hesitation and kind of shiftiness from her that the audience know that something is up, but they don't know what, and they won't guess what it is. And it's such an incredible performance by Saskia in those scenes, as Gary is just sort of playing with her.
Yeah,
it's in this wonderful way.
So, so good. All right. Well, I think I probably have time for one more question. So I've read a lot of your interviews, and it seems like people are always asking you about the balance of comedy and drama in Slow Horses. And I'm not going to ask you about that, but I bring it up to say that I know you get asked a lot of the same questions all the time. And I was just curious if there is an aspect of the show that you don't get asked about a lot that maybe you would like to bring attention to or put the spotlight on in some way.
Oh, that's, That's for, I mean, I can tell you the aspect of the show that I wish was championed more, but because they do such a good job, nobody knows that they're doing it, is the production design by Choi Ho Man, who, for instance, in series three, the facility, that underground shootout, everything that was underground was a set. Not a location, but you just don't know that because it just feels like we went to some old abandoned tunnels and did it. But she and her team built that. And so I just feel the crew, you know, because it just, you don't question it. You don't get asked so much about that, but it's like, you know, everybody on that crew with a, you know, it's like, you know, we all try and be as good at our jobs as Gary Oldman is as good at his, and all those heads of departments are delivering on that level. And that it's such a huge part of the show, you know, the locations, the lighting, the kind of the design, the set dressing is always just immaculate and so layered. And that's what lifts the performances even higher, is just, it's so immersive what that crew do. So, I mean, I never get asked about that because people just don't know it. They don't know when things are set. It's like Lamb's house in this was a set, you know, that looks like a real place. And, even I think somebody, some other company rang to say, where did you film the MI5 scenes? We'd like to use that location. And we had to say, no, we built that. That's ours. So,
oh, man. Yeah, that's an incredible shout out. I had no idea that bunker was.
The bunker's all. Yeah. All the underground stuff. We built it and then we tore it down. It's just sad. You think you should give it to somebody. Go and make a student film there or something, low budget film, because it was fantastic.
Cool. Well, I think I'm out of time with you, but Will, this has been so much fun, and congrats on the show. And I hope you guys can keep it going, because it's just one of my favorite things on TV. It's so incredible to be able to come back to something this consistently and on a tight schedule. And it's just so enjoyable. So thank you so much. Oh,
thank you so much for saying that. And I really enjoyed this discussion. Thank you. It's a really, really fun chat.
All right, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about Slow Horses at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a few things in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you all tomorrow.